Hi folks, before we start the podcast, it's that little rattle the bucket time, and I know you want to press the forward 30 seconds, but I'd ask you not to. This is actually a really good podcast, and I would say that because I really nerded it out. It was recorded a couple of weeks ago for our Patreon subscribers. People have given us great feedback in relation to what it means as for Tax Haven Ireland and as an entity. And all of those podcasts, and I just looked, the 790 podcasts available on the Patreon feed. I actually scratching my head. I can't believe it's 790. But nonetheless, we put up a lot of content, and it doesn't happen without the support of our members. We would really appreciate if some of you who are listening, there's thousands of you listening, would take that credit card or PayPal or Revolut, whatever you do now, and the price of a fancy cup of coffee, shall we say, once a month at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The link is in this podcast. It'll be at the bottom. Just, you know, hit the button, join us, get access to all the extra content and these podcasts as they're done. And please, it helps us keep going. It helps us making the content. I'm very excited. If you're listening to this today, earlier this morning, you missed a brilliant podcast with John Schwartz from The Intercept. And as we speak, a new police is hitting the Patreon feed. So you're missing those currently. We try to make everything free as we can. But please join us. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And enjoy this podcast. I really did nerd out. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and we are going back to one of my favorite bugbears, one of my favorite topics, and it is Tax Haven Ireland. It's something that we've covered extensively across the Tortoise Shack for a number of years now, and it's been brought to life now by our guest. But before I go there, I have to talk to my co-host, Martin. Martin, how's things with you? You're still busy defending yourself on Twitter from all the attacks, are you?
Not at all. Actually, I was reading back very recently when Enda Kenny was Taoiseach, and the OECD came out with a report saying that we weren't a tax haven. And I think it was 2015, and Enda jumped upon it, and it became frontline news. We are not a tax haven, but in reality, we are.
Well, okay, we can. I actually can't even believe you brought that up, because I would say that doesn't really count to the basis of this conversation. Let's leave that nonsense outside the door, please, because that's been, you know, proven time and time again. I'm engaged in a Twitter spat at the moment with economist Seamus Coffey, and he's gone so far as to say yes, we need to review certain things. But nonetheless, look, there is a new book. It's called Tax Haven Ireland. It's co-authored by Brian O'Boyle and Kieran Allen. And one of the authors, Dr. Brian O'Boyle, is here to join us. He's an economist, a member of PBP, and he's lectured on political economy in the Irish education system. Brian, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having us, Tony.
No, look, as you can tell, we fall very firmly on the side of that Ireland has been a tax haven for a number of years now, for more than a number of years, if we're being honest. It simply has gotten more efficient at it. But if you wouldn't mind giving listeners, first of all, an overview of why the book and the historical context, and then we might dig down into some of the things that you actually, I think, break down quite well within the book.
Okay, thanks. Well, the first thing I would say is this is the second book that myself and Kieran have written on the Irish economy. We wrote one in 2013 called Austerity Ireland, the Failure of Irish Capitalism. And in the process of writing that book, you know, that was written in the teeth of the recession, of people losing their jobs, but also the awful austerity that most people on the show will have remembered. It became clear to us that there was a bigger story to tell about the tax haven. So in that book, we referenced it. We had one chapter, but we figured there was a bigger story to tell. And the immediate catalyst was, if you remember 2016, in the summer of 2016, two important things happened. One was the European Commission, after a long investigation, came back and effectively labelled Ireland a tax haven off the back of its relationship with Apple. And a slightly less high-profile case, but one that was no less important, was the Sunday Business Post broke a story where, you know, upwards of 10 enormous, very powerful vulture funds had made, you know, in the region of between three and into the tens of millions of euros in the state. And yet they'd all miraculously declared their profit taxes as 250 euro, which was basically an administrative fee. So, you know, enormous profits, but no taxes. And so we felt, listen, this is a story has to be told. So that was the basic background to why we wrote the book. And I suppose the aim of the book is to, as you said yourself, to sort of nail them in a way, because there's a lot of obfuscation, you know, even this morning, there's a lot of talk about how Ireland is this miraculously successful economy at attracting foreign direct investment. And that's part of a story. But the real story behind that is that Ireland is one of the most deviant states in the world. It sucks money out of poor countries. It organizes corporate affairs so that they can undermine democracy. You know, it's part of a nexus of tax deviant states. And we therefore wanted to tell that story so that we can have a more democratic, grown-up conversation in this country about the kind of policies we think would be good for ordinary people.
Okay, but a couple of things I want to put out there just for listeners' benefits that have come out in the last couple of hours, obviously, is that given our corporation tax has now exceeded 15 billion, right, our receipts are at an all-time high, given that we're supposed to be in a global pandemic and lots of economies are in negative and lots of, you know, lots of economies are struggling, Ireland is thriving. So much so that 1 euro in every €4.50 collected in total taxes is from corporation taxes. Brian, you referenced austerity and how at the time, if you recall, people said we were overly reliant on stamp duty and construction. At its worst, I believe that was 1 euro in every 11. Now we're looking at 1 euro in every 4.50. My God, what an over-reliance. And second thing I'll say is, I remember Pham was on from Vietnam, from the Global Alliance of Tax Justice with us a few months ago. And she said that the new global minimum corporation tax rate, what it actually created wasn't a floor, it created a ceiling. It meant that they would have less money in Vietnam. And that not only, she said, and in Ireland, you're very proud of it. And that wasn't just that wasn't just her speaking. That is the international perception that we are very proud of how we do this. So you might give me some context of how we got here, if you don't mind, what steps we took, because we didn't just wake up and say, we're going to become a tax haven one morning. There had to be key players and there had to be political decisions behind it.
Yeah. Well, if you don't mind, I'll answer that in two parts. I mean, there's an immediate answer to your question, which is, in a way, today's report or today's announcement is a real vindication of what we argue in the book, because what we say in the book is that in 2015, when the Irish state understood that the double Irish was coming to an end, which was the previous sort of gold-plated tax evasion strategy used by the Irish establishment, they moved from one whereby Ireland was effectively like a trampoline. So during the double Irish, what happened was money was sucked into the Irish economy. But it didn't stay here. It bounced back out again, usually to the Caribbean. And so it didn't really show up in our national accounts. Ireland was a tax haven at the time. There were benefits for the Irish elites in that policy, but one of the benefits wasn't really an enormous tax take. That changed in the new model, whereby now what they do is they do what's called onshoring of intellectual property. That intellectual property is now housed in Ireland, and therefore those companies are more likely to pay a bigger proportion of the tax in Ireland. And that means the Irish tax take has gone up fourfold since 2014. Now, we all know that it would be almost impossible to argue with a straight face that the Irish economy has quadrupled in 4 years, or that corporations have, you know, somehow miraculously got four times more successful. So why? And the only reason for it is because they've changed the tax evasion strategy. That's one point. But you're asking me for a longer sort of
You've hinted at it. We've had the Anne's Backer accounts. We've had the Isle of Man. We've had all of these. We have a long history of looking after the elites. So the book argues that we simply corporatized that. We professionalized it. And to go back to what Martin said in 2015, by the way, Martin, that report, what it effectively said was the amount of tax evasion, if I recall, and Brian, you might correct me, with going through Ireland was actually bigger than any of the Caribbean, all of the Caribbean islands that are famous for combined. That's what it said. You know, you can cherry pick whatever line you want from it, but we were actually, if you added up all of these well-known tax havens, they didn't even come up to what Ireland was doing in 2015. Sorry, Brian.
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, and one other thing to say, and it's not in the book, but one of the strategies of the Irish establishment after the Great Recession was to reorganize income tax. So one of the other reasons why we're having these stellar performances in tax is because workers were expected to pay much more after the Great Recession than before the Great Recession. So, for example, we all know the universal social charge is the most obvious one. But actually, if you look at the way they did it in terms of tax bans and the way that they reorganized the tax system, PAYE workers in particular are now paying more tax. So that's the other side of the story. So when you talk about an economy where we're in enormous inflation and yet there's enormous tax takes, that tells you workers need a pay rise. So one of the key things I would be arguing for in work is to say that workers now need to have a readjustment. And the quickest way to get that is higher wages for working people. But when you say about the Ansbacher and so on, yeah, I mean, the way we tell the story, Ireland is a post-colonial society. Up to the 50s, they try various strategies. One of them is economic protectionism, economic nationalism. By the 1950s, they start to look towards first UK capitalism and then US capitalism. And after over the course of about three decades, what happens is that the establishment realize that when they bring foreign investment in, they have to protect local Irish capitalists as well. Because big foreign companies can be a boon to the economy, but they can also undermine the competitiveness of domestic companies. So what happens is they get this kind of doffier cap to international capitalism. Everyone knows about that. But less kind of well told is the part about the cronyism and the corruption that emerges in Ireland around domestic capitalism. Charles Haughey is the kind of symbolic figure of all of that, but he's not on it by any means on his own. I'll give you one fact about him and then I'll shut up. Haughey was found to have taken bribes of 180 times his official salary. Now, on the one hand, you might say the gall of the man to have done that. We all know about him living in, castles with servants and so on on a ministerial salary. But who gave him that money? The question is, the bad apple, this bad apple was the center of a whole system. He was like the sun with all the other planets moving around him. But all those other planets were other major businessmen, property developers, owners of big Irish companies. And all of those people felt that by giving Haughey tax advantages, they would benefit too. So the whole system was corrupt. And he was the symbolic, the front of house of all of that. So yeah, that was what happened. And as you say, I like the way you put that. They effectively corporatized that by saying, listen, we have all the tools here. We're already in an enormously corrupt country. We already have a history of offering tax advantages to American companies. The big trigger was the founding of the single European market, actually, because that allowed for enormous increases in flows of capital around Europe. And Margaret Thatcher deregulated the city of London. So when all of that came together, all the stars aligned, they set up the International Financial Services Center and off they went into tax evasion in an enormous scale.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment and say, you keep saying tax evasion. The people will tell you it's tax avoidance because these are our rules, these are our laws, and we play amongst them. And to go back to the point that Pascal Donohue made, when the OECD came out and issued its traffic light system of green, red, amber, and red, Ireland was the only tax haven on it with a green rating, because even though the tax laws themselves were in effect giving advantages that you couldn't get in other countries, they were indeed found to be our laws, Brian, and they were they were tax avoidance rather than tax evasion.
Yeah, and that's the crux of it in a way, Tony, because you see, in the end, when you're a sovereign state, you decide what's legal. And so, if the state is organizing tax avoidance or evasion or dodging or whatever you want to call it, but it's also giving it a legal imprimatur, well, then it becomes legal and therefore it shifts from being evasion to avoidance. But that's a bit like saying it was legal to murder Nazis in Nazi Germany. So therefore, in other words, the law is reflective of the interests of the elites. And so, yes, strictly speaking, a lot of it is avoidance. But if you're asking any common person in the street, if you're an Irish citizen, you get to 18 years of age, you're expected to pay your tax. If you could say you're living in, you know, the Cayman Islands and you didn't pay your tax and then you called it avoidance because the state allowed you to do it, well, no, it wouldn't be. It would be evasion because the state doesn't allow you to do it. So really, in the end, what matters is what the state allows, and what the state allows becomes avoidance. In the book, we're careful to say, yeah, a lot of it is actually avoidance, or what we might call tax dodging. But, you know, sensible people would say, under any ordinary moral definition, it's evading your responsibility. It's evading your taxes when you really should pay them.
Martin, I know you want to come in, but I want to make one point on that. And it's not in the book. There's other really, really good examples that you should read, folks. I recall about a kilometer from where I sit down the road in Drumcondra that there was a house that was, when they called it the Panama Papers, they could have just called it the Drumcondra Papers. Because there's a house just around the corner from me. The house alone had over nearly 400 letterbox companies, shall we call them politely, affiliated with it. So this is very definitely something that we can outsource it and call them the Panama Papers. We're actually really good at Sorry, Martin, I know you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the concept that they then bowed more or did more clientelism with domestic companies. Because that's where we end up, where you've no sick pay. That ends up where conditions are so poor for a lot of people in precarious employment. That's where we end up. And they have. I mean, I've documented this until I'm blue in the face. That is exactly what they have done. So instead of benefiting from living in a tax haven, it actually drags standards down to the floor. Absolutely drags them down to the floor for workers.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it, Marty, whereby if you look at certain statistics, you know, Ireland is often ranked as one of the most successful countries in the world for GDP, for gross domestic product. I was looking at a figure one day and it struck me that if you look at an average family of four and you divide our GDP across the citizens of the country, you'd be looking at each family having about €240,000 per annum. That's the kind of distortion that the tax haven brings. You know, in other words, if this money was really Irish people's money, we would be an enormously successful. You know, you would see an enormous difference. But of course, a lot of it is creative accounting to allow for profits that are not being generated in the state to come into the state. And so there's an enormous distortion there.
But now, can I push back and say that, and again, I don't believe this. I think, you know, guys, I'm on the record. I believe we need to have just taxation globally. We need to act globally, think globally, and work that way. Same when it comes to climate action. But they will push back and they'll say, well, aren't France doing these deals off the books? Aren't Germany doing these deals? Aren't these other countries doing these deals? And sure, you know, every country is acting in its own interests. So therefore, beggar thy neighbor is actually a good policy.
Well, what I'd say is, I mean, Marty was touching on the point, you know, isn't the acid test quality of life? Isn't the acid test how secure and how comfortable the average person in the country is? That's how I would that's how I would measure the success, not the idea of the tax take or abstract numbers around GDP, but like, can you get good childcare for your kids? Can you afford a home without worrying about when you're going to make your mortgage payment?
Can I come in again and just say you actually do? You have an entire chapter on that in the book,
The point of it is that if you look at Ireland in terms of, for example, the cost of childcare, we're one of the highest costs in Europe.
Third highest.
For the cost for an ordinary family. If you look at our pupil-teacher ratio, in terms of, if we talk about knowledge being the great leveler, then you should have really low pupil-teacher ratios if you're in one of these big tax havens and it's benefiting us. Actually, we've got some of the worst pupil-teacher ratios. If you talk about your own family, everyone here knows people who are on a housing waiting list and on a health waiting list. Everybody does, because most of us are on them somewhere. And, you know, I'm waiting on a health intervention that I can't get. You know, why? Because the state systematically underfunds its public services. So what we have is an incredibly rich economy in official statistics. We have an elite group of maybe 10 to 15% who certainly do well out of this. I mean, if you look at the income tax receipts for the wealthiest, there's over 200,000 tax units now, either married or single people who earn over 100 grand. So clearly those people do very well out of the tax haven. It's not a mirage. It exists and there's wealth here.
But the book points
but
at
hang
that.
On, hang on, Tony. But the question is, does it benefit the average person? Does it benefit your listener? Because you see, the Irish state wants you to believe your argument about the, you know, the sort of beggar thy neighbour is good for everyone. In other words, Ireland Inc. is doing well. Everyone should row in behind it. My argument is there's no such thing as Ireland Inc. There's an elite and there's the rest. And the rest of us have to realise that we would be better off, for example, if you looked at the industrial policy of a country like Denmark or Finland, small countries that have actually have a proper industrial development strategy, that means that the people in the country do better than the Irish people on average do. So the tax haven is a three-card trick.
I'm going to actually deviate from the book for a moment and actually point out that the CSO's most recent stats showed that, you know, 30% of people with disabilities are living in poverty, are living in deprivation. Okay, 29%, almost 29% of people in the lowest income decile live in poverty. Right, so we've a huge cohort who are the working poor and are dependent upon, as we make the argument all the time, some form of social transfer, be that HAP or FIS or child benefit, just to be lifted out of the at-risk of poverty category. And that's why we're able to show that the country that has the biggest growing economy in the world, basically in many regards, is dysfunctional. Because on the flip side, and you point to this in the book, Brian, is that the workers in the companies that are availing of this, you might not notice, Martin, but you know, they say you do a day's work, you do 8 hours. Well, you're doing 8 hours. Most of them are doing at least 48, 64 per day because they're so efficient, Brian, aren't they? They generate. No, Martin, you've no idea.
Superhuman. No, Tony, superhuman. There used to be 40 hours work done in 1 hour, for example.
There used to be a guy called Tommy Two Shits, because if you had one, he had two. These people can have six, okay? Because they're knocking out profitability per head of staff that is just unseen anywhere in the globe. They must be Marvel Universe superheroes, Brian.
Yes. Look. It's not the look of the Irish. It's the amazing capacity of the Irish, if you're to believe the national statistics. Another point that maybe I would make is that, you know, you read it this morning. You probably heard it. You definitely would have heard it this morning that Seamus Coffey was saying that about 10 companies are paying about 6 billion of our, you know, you reference the tax. It's something like half, isn't it?
Six companies are like... We've gone over 15 billion for the first time, but we are completely reliant on a handful, 10 pay nearly most of it. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. And the point there is that this is the untold, the other story. Think about that in terms of its implication. What that means, instead of thinking about it in terms of the reliability of the state on 10 companies, and that in a way shows you how dysfunctional the overall system is. Think about the 100,000 companies who pay the rest. You see, one of the things about the tax haven that isn't as well defined is that because it is allowing big multinational companies to do the heavy lifting, most Irish companies don't pay tax on their profits at all. So therefore, you know, you're an ordinary worker, you're a nurse, you're a teacher, you're an operative in a factory, you're working in a supermarket, you're paying your tax. So the point is, we're all paying in because, you know, I feel it's important. I'm lucky enough to be a lecturer, right? So I'm lucky enough to have a good salary. It's well paid and it's secure. And I'm aware of those advantages that I've been given by my society. And I'm very happy then to pay my tax because it goes in to help other kids. You know, I'm from Tala. It'd be good if other kids from Tala get to university and so on. So I can see that I've got to put something back in. I didn't get where I am because of, you know, the genius in my head. I got there because society supported me. But the elites don't think that way. They don't think that they owe anything back to society. They don't think that the fact that we pay for their roads, their electricity, their education for their workers, the infrastructure that allows them to do business, they don't think that that has to be paid for by them. They think the rest of us should pay for that as well. You see,
I'm arguing against myself here, but That's just saying that someone's saying rich person takes advantage of rich situation. That's what they're going to do.
I disagree with you on that, Tony, in that if you want a society that's structured so that you have a more equal society, you can't say that those at the top end, who are basically the conduits between big business and the rest of us, because that's what they are, the facilitators. They're the people who work in the service industry, who service all of these people. They can have a good living and we can't. You're into feudalism but you have a king, you have courtiers, and Martin, you have peasants.
You're both wrong, because where's the outrage from below?
Well, I'd say there
is. No, where
Tony,
is it? Show me where it is. Show me.
Well, look, I mean, where is it? Martin,
who's in power for 100 years, Martin?
Okay. I agree with you. But there are people like me who rage into that void all the time.
People
Tony.
Like you, absolutely. But what I'm saying, and I look, you know as well as I do, I want real systemic and long-lasting change. And I want it on a national and global level. But I'm saying to you that we all see the old meta. What was the old saying? Today's news, wealthy people telling rich people to tell middle-class people to blame poor people.
Yeah.
Okay? There is an element of that to it. But nonetheless, we live in a society, Brian, I put it to you.
Yeah.
The book actually makes clear to me, clearer than anything some of the other celebrity economists do, by the way. That's why I really enjoyed it. That, unfortunately, too many people go, rather than go, we would like a redistribution, I'd like a piece of that. And that's what makes it difficult to break through.
Well, look, I mean, put it this way, right? There's an interesting phenomenon in Ireland where school kids know the rate of tax the corporations pay. Now, do you think that's true in, you know, Finland or in, you know, Austria? Of course it's not. Mm. I mean, you go and ask a 15-year-old, what corporation tax rate do Irish companies pay, or do companies pay in Ireland? Sorry. They'll tell you 12.5%. I know it's changing, but they'll say 12.5%. I've often gone into schools in my job and they tell you that stuff. That's not by chance, Tony. Mm. That is part of a very well-constructed narrative that says Ireland fails without foreign companies and we have to do everything we can to get them here, including give them much lower taxes than the workers in their offices or the cleaners in their offices. That's the narrative, right? And what you're saying there is that Irish people are, you know, well, you're not saying quite, but the question is, are people angry? I think they are, actually. I mean, if you think about, even take one statistic, in the 1980s, up to 95% of the Dáil seats went to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Labour Party. That was basically where we were in elections in the 1980s. And as you know, historically, when Fianna Fáil did well, Fine Gael did badly. And similarly, you know, the other way around, it was like the A and the B team of Irish capitalism. We noted in the most recent election, both parties had their second worst election ever simultaneously. In other words, they both did very badly. The reason they both did very badly is because people are looking for change. Now, that change is not what I would argue is, you know, radical socialist transformation. That's not what people are looking for yet. What they want is a fair crack. And what they see in Sinn Féin is a party that will give them a fair crack. So I think people are moving and they're looking for change. And it's worth also saying, actually, that, you know, Sinn Féin's vote was obviously massively impressive. About 30 or 40% of their transfers were going to People Before Profit. And the reason I say that is because that tells you that the people who are voting for them, number one, in a kind of a proportional representation system, are left-wing voters. They're looking for change to the left.
Even if they don't... I'd agree with you 100%. Even if they don't realize they're of the left, they may think they're social democratic class.
Yeah, absolutely, and
now, again, we don't know the color of Sinn Féin's money because they've been speaking very quietly, positively about some of the Ireland's position on tax. Absolutely. You know, and that will be something that we will review on this podcast and continue to review. But I do think what the book does really well, and I mean, I'm full of compliments for I really enjoyed it. That's probably the nerd in me as well. But I just think that it puts in context how people with influence use that influence to guide that policy. So when you say half a dozen companies can pay 50% of our corporation tax rate, and then understand, and I'm going to make that very real for people. One of the first things Leo Varadkar pledged when he moved from the minister to the leader of Fine Gael to therefore the Taoiseach, was that he was going to put in just something simple as a digital safety commissioner. If you recall, it was one of his first pledges. Okay. A few days later, he met the lads from Facebook. A few weeks later, unrelated, Fine Gael ministers got free social media training. And a few weeks later, nothing happened in terms of the digital safety commissioner. Now, I can't tell you what happened in the corridors of power, but it does ask questions to people who say, why did you say one thing and then it go away? Now, you put that in the context of a group like Matheson, PwC, Ernst & Young, KPMG, and they're just the people who actually, you know, I don't know, Brian, if you're aware of the I use the same analogy all the time. I refer to Ireland as the Wavin pipes of the world. Right? We have, do you remember the old Wavin pipes that we used to see on the telly all the time? That we have the best Wavin pipes that you want to filter your money through. It'll lash on through. We charge you a service charge. And that service charge could be anywhere from 2% to 12.5%. But, you know, it's somewhere in there. And I do think people need to wake up to that. And I think the book demonstrates that quite well. What I would argue, though, is we need to bring more people with us, because there's too many people in the middle who don't look at it as the elites versus us. They look at it as the coping classes are taking the money from me.
Mm. Well, I mean, maybe we should look a little bit at the link between the tax haven and the housing crisis, because that would be something that people would be very familiar with.
Absolutely.
You know, often very angry about.
And it's detailed in the book, but go on ahead.
Yeah, it's detailed in the book. And what we found, there was an interesting story, actually. So what seems to have happened is Fine Gael come into office. They come into the crisis. As you know, obviously Fianna Fáil were punished at the election in 2011 because they were the ones who were in charge during the Great Recession. And an enormously influential vulture fund basically seems to have approached Fine Gael ministers at the World Economic Forum and offered to buy NAMA off them, full, you know, basically the whole lot.
Yeah, that's true. That happened.
So that was refused. That offer was refused, but it seems to have been a light bulb moment for the elites, because you couldn't very well sell the whole loan. The vulture fund was called Lone Star, a big Texas vulture fund.
Can I be really bold and say Lone Star operate under another name called Hudson Advisors? So all of these people, so they go, these companies aren't here. They're here in triplicate. Yeah, they're here absolutely. in various names.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard. That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, because it's cost-free and very easy to continually replicate and multiply your corporate entities, it's very hard to follow them. But yeah, so the point is, it would have been almost impossible for them to just up and sell the whole of the Irish property portfolio to one vulture fund. But what Freedom of Information requests showed was, over the next 2 years, they had 65 different meetings with a whole range of vulture funds. And they sort of piecemeal sold it off in blocks. And so they sold off an awful lot of property, an awful lot of land, and really good strategic assets went. So one of the dynamics here was, key people from the Irish property industry, first of all, were brought into NAMA. They served their time in NAMA. One of the things they did in NAMA was they scoped out the territory. They found out, where is the best land? Where are the best assets? Which value is the most likely to pay a dividend quickly? And then they all jumped off and they went working for the people who were
and that is absolutely categorically true.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all detailed. There's a book called Namaland if you're interested.
I know, but I just want to make a point on it though. They went off, then they knew what value the state would accept. So they went back to NAMA and they said, we'll give you whatever it was, say 40 cent on the euro on this loan book or whatever it is. And not only did they do that, but some of the people involved in these colossal, you're talking billions, they all got Irish passports as a kind of sweetener, as a thing. I mean, like, we don't talk about this enough. I mean, there's people working in our health service who can't stay here legally yet because of our residency rules and the way they do. But these lads who bought and pillaged our loans, they got Irish passports as rewards, in effect.
Absolutely. And so they turn back up in things like REITs, which are special property-based financial vehicles that effectively were tailored to the Irish market and which don't pay tax. You know, they, as long as they redistribute the profits quickly...
They pay minimal tax.
But they don't pay corporation tax. What they do is they tell the state that they're going to recycle the profits quickly to the shareholders, and therefore it will be kind of double taxation if you charge the entity and the shareholder who gets the profit.
They have an exemption.
But in the end, they don't pay tax. Another thing that happened was the a whole series of vulture funds. So in other words, the initial phase is the state goes out and offers these vulture funds, has 65 independent meetings with them. And at the chair, if you remember, in 2012, the Irish state did something it hadn't done before. It brought in a guy from finance into the Department of Finance and put him in the top job, a guy called John Moran. Now, usually, as your listeners may know, Ireland's a very conservative place. And if you want to become the Secretary General in a department, that's a life career sort of progression. You take steps as you go through. But in this case, they brought a guy in from international finance. He goes into the job. There's 65 meetings with these vulture funds. And then what happens over the next 2 years? An enormous wall of cash comes into the Irish property sector. You see, what NAMA did was it stopped the collapse. The Irish establishment, for all sorts of reasons, one of them to do with the tax haven, have traditionally gone into property and land. Land and property are very safe assets because they can be, you know, rezoned, for example. You can get windfalls if there's estate development happening on land. And crucially, if you own land, you have a monopoly because, you know, Americans can't come in and bring extra land into the state. They can bring in extra washing machines or T-shirts or computers. So if you own land, you know someone has to deal with you in order to get that land. So for all sorts of reasons, the Irish elites, you know, had a preference for land. And that's why during the Great Recession, it was so much of an existential threat to them, because the land and the property market absolutely collapsed. NAMA was phase one, stop the collapse from happening, stop the collapse in prices. Stage two was to partner up with a wall of international finance that would reflate the property market, would reflate the value in that system, and would get the prices of those assets back up and would repair the value balance sheets of the richest people in the state. That's what it was done for.
It was, I'm going to say, it was also done for people who had been buried in negative equity, in a way. Whether you want to say that's a side effect or an impact, people were buried in negative equity because gobshites like me were giving out 100% mortgages.
I've said it quite a lot, Tony, that when the banks were bailed out, it wasn't the banks that were saved. It was the top crust of the Irish elite that were saved. That banks were saved was secondary to that decision.
Not financially, Martin. I mean, the bank, like you got to think, look at it in terms of the overall bailout, the money that went into the bailout, whether you believe it or not, the money that went into the bailout was short of banks. Some of them should have been allowed to fail. There's no question.
And you did make a great point about the civil service. And considering the comment that from Mary Lou yesterday, this is worth pointing out. None of this happens unless you have a compliant civil service. None of it. You can't have the tax deals, you can't have a tax haven, unless you have a civil service that is so entrenched in allowing that to happen, Tony.
I agree, but I want to come back to what Brian wants to talk about, linking it to the man on the street trying to buy a house, the woman trying to struggle to pay her rent, the family trying to keep a roof over their heads. But I want to make one point. You mentioned John Moore, and I think it's very important that you did, because John has a background in finance, but hasn't a clue about property, right? Doesn't have a clue about that. And that's been proven time and again in some of the disastrous deals that he entered the state into. And I think that's only fair to point out that his tenure in certain aspects has been ropey at best when it comes to the fact that they never turned back on any sort of housing, public housing, social housing, affordable housing under his tenure. And he had all the tools to do it. NAMA's founding document, by the way, we have to recall, was said that it could act in the interests of serving the citizens of the state. It was in the first bloody fourth paragraphs where we had, so NAMA chose to be an economic vehicle as opposed to a societal one. Sorry, Brent, let's go
So the point is, right, okay. So all this money comes in, and just as you're saying there, Moran's involved centrally in sort of bringing in and explaining the advantages that are there. What you also said that's important is it was very clear immediately that what could happen, for example, and it's better to be concrete here. So say the IBRC, which was the old Anglo-Irish, right? Say it has 1,000 mortgages on one of its loan books, right? Those mortgage holders are being, you know, squeezed for 100% of their payments back. That's the point. But if you're a Lone Star or you're, you know, a Cerberus or you're, you know, any number of the American Vulture Funds, you can get a deal. If you take 1,000 mortgages off the hands of the IBRC, they will give you them at a 60% discount. Now, as you say, if you're a local teacher who, or say, for example, you're someone who worked in a bank, but not at a high level and you lost your job because of someone else's decisions, right? Yeah, okay. So if you were probably told, listen, Tony, we're going to give you your mortgage at a 60% discount now. You could probably find a way to pay that and keep yourself in your house, right? Effectively, that was what was happening, except it was only available to elite finance companies because you had to buy 1,000 mortgages or at least 100. You know, you could, it wasn't available to you. You couldn't club together even with 100 other mortgage holders and buy the loan book. It was only available to these big companies. So point one is they get the point men from the NAMA to tell them the, what's available. Point two is they get particular advantages that nobody else gets. They get enormous discounts. Point three, and this is where the tax haven comes in, they get this vehicle called a Section 110, which allowed them to lend money to themselves. And then when they go off, so what happens is, say you've got Company A, let's say it's an American Vulture Fund. The American Vulture Fund sets up a second company in the IFSC. Let's call that Company B. Company B is going to be the company that does the trading in Ireland, right? But it has no money yet. So it borrows money off Company A. Same, you know, it's the parent lending money to the offspring, right? The offspring then goes off and does its deals in the Irish economy. And as it does those deals, it makes its profits. But the Irish tax code allows these companies to say, before you pay taxes on your profits, you can pay any interest charges you might have. And miraculously, the amount of interest they were paying to their parent company through obviously complex circuitous routes just happened to wipe out all the taxes they would pay on their profits.
Right.
So basically, they got these tax-free profits as well as the initial write-down. They're getting the tax-free profits. And the final point on this is they also revived, as Marty said, the key players in the Irish sector, because all the property developers who were involved in crashing the economy were also the ones who were looked to by these international funds as their local partners. People who knew, as you said, about the land deals, about the available stuff. And so they bought up all the stuff when everyone else was broke. And that's why we haven't had any building on the public land or on the, sorry, now on this land, because they recognize that as a monopoly, if they drip feed land in or if they don't build very much, supply always lags against demand and prices stay high. So I'm
gonna give you a little insight into that.
Yeah.
I was talking to a guy and we remember, like, I got in so much trouble professionally, as most listeners probably know, for some of the stuff I've alluded to. But I remember when we were talking about this situation, trying to explain it to another journalist how it was happening, and I said it's like the Matrix, you know, the green thing going down. It was like this portfolio is doing so well. On the other side, we need to raise the interest rate by this to wipe out that, right? And I was trying to, I think they were like, but what? I said, no, this is how we're offsetting one against the other to wipe out any profit, so there's no tax liability, even though we've effectively made maybe 140 million on the deal. Yeah. And it was only a couple of years later where someone came back to me with, you said that to me, didn't you? And I went, yeah, I fucking said it to you. But nonetheless, Brian, what that meant is that we locked in on affordability that was there, because we had rents that had come down. We had house prices that had come down. And we didn't just pump them up really quickly. We inflated them rapidly. Yeah. And now we're left with the most expensive rents, the house prices that are going to continue to rise. And unfortunately, a country that's saying, well, if we build 35,000 homes, they want you to forget that we could build 90,000 homes a year as well. And now, and actually we should be able to do it easier now, because there's companies in Carlow, I believe, and definitely one across in Leeds that can deliver you, ready-made houses in a few weeks. They can knock them out now. So we certainly it's a lack of ambition, but at whose cost?
Well, you made a point about, you know, that NAMA bailed out the ordinary person in negative equity. And again, that's partly true, but I want to maybe flesh it out slightly, because say, for example, you're somebody with one home and you lose 40% of the value. When you go to buy a new home, you're also buying a home that's 40% cheaper. So the point is, unless you have more than one home, high prices and low prices, a bit academic. You win on, you know, the swings and roundabouts. You know, you can sell your house at a record high rate, but then when you go to buy one, guess what? You're paying a record high rate. So if you've only got one house, it doesn't matter whether they're low or high. It's the point is, when you've got two properties, then high prices start to matter, because now you can sell something and not have to buy something else. That's a very important point, because Middle Ireland, you know, have been sold a pig and a poke. The idea that somehow you're getting rich because your price of your house is high. Not true, unless you're either passing it on when you die, or you're somehow going to just live on. What are you going to do? Like, if you're going to trade up, you're still going to pay a high price. So the key thing to remember is it squeezed everybody except people who had more than one house. If you had one house, it didn't matter one way or the other whether the price were low or high. And secondly, what about all the young people who got no houses, who didn't get on the property ladder? What about all the people who can't afford a house, who have to rent? What about people who are on the social housing waiting lists, who are waiting years and years and years because they can't build, because that will increase supply and undermine their strategy? So, you know, it might sound quite conspiratorial, but look, the evidence is, in 2016, Fine Gael came out with a big fanfare document. You probably covered it on your show. The idea of, you know, house building Ireland. We're going to have, do you remember Simon Coveney pledged that by the summer of 2016, no more homeless people, right? And then he was, and you know, in order to make sure that there was no egg on his face, he jumped out into foreign affairs before he failed to deliver on that one, right? So the point of it is that this has been going on. If it was a crisis, they would have solved it. Look at how they approached.
Oh, no, COVID. No, it is a crisis, Brian, because I want to, for listeners' benefits, some of the emergency accommodation that we refer to now, what we haven't referred to explicitly, but Brian, you've alluded to it, that's the solution they came up with. Rather than house people and saying people won't be in hotels, we'll come up with the concept of hubs, family hubs, we'll call them. Yeah. And we'll say there's a games room and, you know, and they can all sit in this de facto hotel, right? Okay. And unfortunately, we've seen the damage that's been doing long term, the ACEs that it's doing to children, but also not really spoken about is some of them are, I know, four within 5 kilometers of here who are owned by, effectively, you follow the money, Goldman Sachs. So yeah, the same gangs, absolutely. They own them and they're profiting from them. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it couldn't be any crueler.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, the figure, it's very hard to get definitive facts, but I've read the Sunday Business Post had a figure of 200 billion. Like, it's just an enormous giveaway. It's very hard to fathom. And as you, like, there are sites all over the country. I think at the moment there are about 815 or 820 public sites. And the question becomes, right, you have hundreds of thousands of people who either can't afford a home or who are on waiting lists or worse, are homeless. And you've got, like, land available, as you say. Money has never been cheaper. You can borrow money. The state can borrow money really cheap. I mean, as we know, and all three of us know, the state has borrowed about 40 billion to cope with COVID. Fair play. That's a good idea. You know, you got to get through a crisis. But what about this other crisis? What about this crisis that's been going on for 8-10 years for people? You know, because, you know, homelessness is not contagious to rich people in the same way as COVID is. And that's the big difference, you see. You can put up with homelessness knowing it won't affect you. You can put up with knowing that other people will suffer from having 50 or 60% of their wages taken by a landlord or by a vulture fund because it's not you. So the point of it is that this is not a crisis in the sense that, you know, COVID is a crisis. It's a manageable problem for them. It's a crisis if you're in the problem. If you're the person who can't afford a home, or if you're struggling to get to save your money to get on the property ladder, then it's a crisis. I get that. I mean, we all agree with that. But it's important to see that it's also a profitable opportunity for very, very many people. And that's the reason why it will remain a crisis for most ordinary people. And as I said, Tax Haven Ireland is completely knitted into the fabric of the housing crisis. And so it's important to see that, you know, this kind of, you know, cheerleading that happens effectively on RTE this morning about how we've never had it so good because the tax take is so high. Well, the question there is, are they going to use that tax take to build houses? I would very much doubt it.
And is that the aim of your book? Is that what you'd like the book to do, is to change the thought processes of those involved and telling us that it's a great idea that rich people are wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question, because I think what we want the book to do is, first of all, to draw back the veil of lies that are told in the state. You know, the first casualty of the Irish tax haven, in a way, is democracy. Because we live in a society where we're meant to have democratically elected representatives. And those representatives are meant to represent the people who vote for them. And yet, they will lie systematically about the nature of the Irish economy. I mean, we all know, look at the institutions that have called Ireland a tax haven, right? You've got all of the tax justice organizations, all of the serious charities who use resources in this area. They've got no axe to grind, right? They're not there to sort of, they don't go around willy-nilly labeling every state in the world a tax haven.
The US Senate,
exactly.
We had the European Commission. What was the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, the long-running Danny DeVito thing, referred to Ireland recently in an episode as a tax haven.
Leprechaun economics. I mean, we are in a way a laughing stock, and the only people who come out and defend and sort of deny that Ireland is a tax haven are establishment insiders. Whether it's, establishment economists, whether it's people working in the accountancy industry or the legal profession, or whether it is establishment politicians. So people with an axe to grind, with skin in the game, those are the people who consistently deny we're a tax haven. Everybody else who's serious tells the truth. So we want to tell the truth, and we want to write a very, and I think it's a rigorous book because it has over 1,000 references in the book. We're trying to say, listen, this is a serious book that does serious research and puts a serious case to the Irish elites. And we would like journalists and I'm very grateful for yourselves for taking the book seriously and reading it. So thank you very much. But we would like the average, there is now, isn't there, Marty, a kind of a mature Irish audience who, maybe they were fed on Vincent Brown, for example, who did a great service, whereby there was a politicization of a whole layer of Irish people because of the Great Recession. So there is a layer of people out there now who want to understand the nature of Irish society and who want a grown-up discussion about our democracy, what kind of society we want long-term. And with the issues around, for example, climate change, we think we're in an enormously transformative period of capitalism, and we need a state that will actually not do the bidding of corporations and make power even more remote from the democratic forces, but actually we need a much more democratic society. So the book is written in the interest of our democracy, and it's written as a kind of denouncing the sort of grubby nature of Irish capitalism and arguing for a more progressive and a more hopeful, in a way, and a more positive future for Irish society.
Well, thanks very much for coming on, having this chat with us, Brian. And I do agree with you. Like all governments have gone a little bit green. And if you're not a little bit green these days, you're not in government. But also, the closer we get to the climate action cliff edge, the more and more governments are going to become people before profit. And I genuinely believe that. I think there is no other direction. So thanks very much indeed for coming on and having this conversation with us.
I'm going to disagree, Martin. I don't care about your labels. You got to go green, red. That's the only way we're going to get anywhere.
People before profit. It's going to have to go that way.
We need to go green, red. But the other thing I will say is... and this is for everybody who's listening to this thinking, nodding their heads, going, this is all right. Yeah, that's all makes sense. Yeah, yeah. Put some pressure on your own party, whether it's Sinn Féin or it's Sock Dems or PBP or whatever, because that's our listenership is in the left. It's all that. It's that diaspora. Please put pressure on it, because we've seeded the ground. We have Pascal Donoghue with telling people that we've never had it so good in terms of the money that's coming in, and yet they won't. They're playing within the fiscal compact that we don't even have to play within. They're not even spending the money that's available to them. And if we don't do that, we won't redistribute wealth. We won't see an improvement in housing. We won't see an improvement in education, and we won't see healthcare get resolved, because they're doing this skin flint cheap.
Sorry, go on.
No, I'm done.
I was going to say you've never had it so good is to say you don't need to change anything. That's what that message is always.
Yeah. It's also to keep our aspirations too low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen, folks, look after yourselves. Hope everybody's okay, because it's been a shit show of a thing. And I should have said at the beginning, shout out to the teachers, the SNAs, and everybody going back to work. And we really appreciate that. It's a very difficult situation. Nothing but respect. And if you decide that you want to strike, you got support here as well. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now.